If we're thinking about the religious landscape of a particular society, we can't just focus on, say, Christianity, but we need to understand these other belief systems that often tend to persist, even when these more organized transcendental religions are introduced into the society.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. What is the relationship between religion and economic development? Does development mean fewer people are religious in low-income countries or more of them? What causes people to believe, and does organized religion adapt as these societies change? Sarah Lowes of UC San Diego, Eduardo Montero of University of Chicago, and Benjamin Marks of Boston University are the authors of a new review of religion in emerging and developing regions. They join me now. Sarah, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back again.
Same goes for you, Eduardo.
Thank you.
And Ben, who I talked to a while ago. It's always good to have old friends back.
Nice to see you, Tim.
Ben, many social scientists, they assume that development implies that people become less religious. Where does this belief come from?
That's a great question, Tim. So the origin of this belief is a theory that is known in the social sciences as the secularization hypothesis. It's essentially a theory that says that as societies experience economic growth, as more people experience the benefits of economic prosperity, then this reduces demand for religion. And as a result, religion is going to lose its social and its cultural influence. So the theory was proposed most famously by advocates of the so-called modernization theory in the middle of the 20th century. But even before that, many sociologists and philosophers have speculated that religion would decline over the course of human history. That includes people like Voltaire in France, Karl Marx, Nietzsche, and perhaps most famously Max Weber, who argued that advances in sciences would foster a more rational worldview that would ultimately displace supernatural explanations for how the world works.
Has their interpretation been correct in high-income countries?
There's a fair amount of evidence certainly supporting this theory, certainly from Western Europe, which is perhaps the region that experienced the most pronounced decline of religious faith over the course of the 20th century. Today, people in Western Europe have some of the lowest levels of self-reported religiosity in the world. There's also some truth to this story in the US, although there the decline of religiosity seems to have been a lot more recent. So for a long time, the US stood out as a bit of an outlier in the Western world. It was at once a very high-income country, but also a country with a very vibrant religious marketplace. And economists actually have written quite a bit about this. They wrote about how religious competition in the US between, for example, many Protestant denominations, how that might have contributed to the persistence of religiosity in the US. But more recently, over the past 15 years or so, scholars have documented a decline of religiosity in the US as well. It remains to be seen whether this decline is going to be long-lasting or not.
Has the pattern been the same in other parts of the world where we have seen a very large decline in poverty over the last 20, 30 years?
So I think that in other parts of the world, the story has been much more nuanced and much more complex. And so first of all, in many regions, the measures of religiosity that we have from survey data, they do not necessarily show evidence of a decline of religion over the past couple of decades. So that's the case, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, as well as countries that used to belong to the communist bloc, where religious practice has actually been rising since the early 1990s. In many of these countries, the measures of religiosity that we have to describe the decline of religiosity in the West, they might not give us the full picture for two reasons. One is that adherence to what we call big world religions, for example, Christianity or Islam, often coexists with highly resilient traditional beliefs. And then another reason is that religious institutions, they continue to play a very important role in many countries as influential social and political actors, and they're often perceived as very legitimate in doing so. Just looking at measures of individual faith and practice, such as, for example, how often you go to church, that might not give you the full picture when it comes to understanding the evolution of religion on a global scale.
It is tempting to think of religion as something constant, something that never changes, a sort of one true belief. But as Ben's pointed out, in low-income countries, do modern religions adapt to coexist with the traditional beliefs that have been around there for thousands of years?
We shouldn't think of religion as static. So whether or not we're thinking of transcendental big God religions like Christianity or Islam, or whether or not we're taking into account sort of traditional beliefs, We should think of these as dynamic institutions that are responding to the incentives that they face. So if like you're a religion, you want to attract adherents, you want to attract the right type of devoted membership. And how you do that is going to depend on the environment that you're in. What other religions are present? What benefits are they offering? How do you get good people depending on the environment that you're in? And so religions are these dynamic institutions that are going to respond to the incentives that they face based on other religions present and other constraints like presence of government, the types of services that government's offering. There's been a tendency, at least historically, in a lot of this religion work in economics to focus on these so-called big God religions. And we think that this misses an important part of the picture. Across time and across societies, there are lots of different types of belief systems that have existed well before, say, Christianity was introduced or Islam was introduced. And so what that means is that if we're thinking about the religious landscape of a particular society, we can't just focus on, say, Christianity, but we need to understand these other belief systems that often tend to persist even when these more organized transcendental religions are introduced into the society. And so that's something we tried to document in the chapter and something that I'm also thinking about in ongoing work with Nathan Nunn and Etienne Le Rossignol in the context of sub-Saharan Africa.
Yes, what are these other belief systems? Can you give me some examples?
So the danger here is that part of what's really interesting about these traditional belief systems is that they vary quite a lot across contexts. So I can't possibly speak to like every set of traditional beliefs, but I will focus on the context that I tend to know a bit better, which is sub-Saharan Africa, and particularly in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And so the way to think about these traditional beliefs are that people, while they will also be Christian or Muslim, tend to also have these traditional beliefs, like they believe in the importance of their ancestors and being connected to their ancestors, that their ancestors have a vested interest in their life and their well-being and what happens to them. There's also this belief that there are individuals who are able to wield supernatural powers. We might refer to these types of individuals as witches or sorcerers, or that, for example, objects can be imbued with supernatural power. So these are some of the examples of what traditional beliefs might look like. And the important point here is that individuals will be Christian or Muslim or whatever. They will go to church every week, multiple times a week, but also still strongly hold on to these traditional beliefs.
It's very tempting for us to think of what you call the big God religions as just the only belief system that there ever is. But can we think about this as a competition between religions, if we're going to think about it economically, to recruit more adherents?
We've tended to ignore these traditional beliefs, and I think it's to our own detriment as we try to understand the role of religion in society. Yeah. And part of the story then is competition between traditional beliefs that are generally already present and then the introduction of new religions. If you're a new religion and you're entering a new territory, the question you might be asking is, how do I get new people to adopt my religion, to practice my beliefs? And you could imagine there's multiple strategies, and one is to explicitly allow for syncretism, either by not challenging the pre-existing belief system or by incorporating the elements of that belief system that seem to be particularly salient for people. And then another strategy, which is the one that I think may be more prevalent, is to demonize the other traditional belief system and say, if you want to be a true believer in, say, the Christian God, then you need to relinquish your previous beliefs. And this is what we're exploring in this ongoing work in sub-Saharan Africa, where we really find evidence that traditional beliefs are maligned, despite the fact that most people hold these beliefs. Even in present-day sermons from churches across Congo, we find evidence that they talk about traditional beliefs a lot, and when they do, they talk about them quite badly. Uh-huh. And the idea is that if you really want to become a true Christian, you have to forego the set of traditional beliefs that your ancestors have held for generations.
It So I asked in the introduction what causes people to believe. And of course, there are many sources of belief. But one thing that you point out in this review is that many people in low-income countries lead very insecure lives. So is there evidence that religious belief is a source of security in this type of life?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something we really highlight in the review. There's a lot of papers that document this, and it's different types of insecurity. So even though, you know, average incomes have gone up, people in emerging regions still face a lot of shocks and insecurity. It could be things like conflict, living around organized crime, but it could also be income volatility. So average income has gone up, but a lot of people still face a lot of income volatility. And then there's also a lack of institutions to help ensure against shocks like weak states. Religions can be extremely valuable at providing a source of community, support, and identity when there's a lot of changes going on in the economy or a face of insecurity. There's also a cultural demand for religion providing a source of identity in times of change. And that's something anthropologists have talked a lot about, but economists are just starting to think about studying those well.
So that's the idea that, for example, if people are moving to cities, this can be very disruptive to a lot of the things that give them a sense of who they are and where they stand in society. And are we saying that they turn to religion to give them that security in their identity?
Yeah, exactly. There's examples of just when economies develop, there's often structural transformation, people moving from agriculture into cities or urban areas. And that's a quite disruptive event, a lot of change. You're often moving to areas where you don't have very good established networks or other things. And so there's an economic incentive to potentially join religious movements when you move to cities to provide economic security in this kind of precarious environment. People often join religious movements when they migrate because it provides a sense of identity and security when you move into a totally new place where you don't have a community. And so both these things are true at the same time. And there's many examples that we cover, some in the paper as well.
A lot of people who criticize organized religion would criticize it on the basis of it's trying to make people feel better about how bad their lives are. You're saying one of the functions of religion in this case is to give people that economic security to help them through.
Yeah, exactly. And so it can help people adjust to these shocks that are ongoing, especially in contexts where states are weak or there's corruption, you don't have people to turn to or institutions to turn to. Religion can often try to fill that gap in certain places.
This is something that I think Eduardo and I have both observed in our ongoing work in Congo, where there's a lot of rural to urban migration. Life in rural areas is difficult, but also it's difficult in urban areas, particularly when you don't have these well-established networks. And churches seem to be a really key place for people to build community, but also to get a job or a place to stay, or even just basic things like food or money if they face a health shock. And so churches seem to really fill in this social support type role.
When people are religious in these settings, is there evidence that it also affects the way they behave, the choices that they make?
Yeah, absolutely. Economists have started studying all this in very interesting ways, using experiments or natural experiments and measuring religiosity in very creative ways. But there's a lot of work that churches can actually act as informal insurance for people. They mobilize, resources, food, housing, job referrals, things like that. There's a lot of evidence of that. Some of it coming from very nice experiments that people have done, asking people to donate money to people from your same church or not to get a measure of religiosity and preferences, which is super creative. It also changes who your social network is, and that affects what you believe as well over time. So there's a lot of work on this that really speaks to that, exactly what you're talking about.
But to be meaningful, religions have to have, how would we say, rules, standards of behavior. Is there evidence that they're also shaping how norms are evolving in these societies?
There's definitely evidence that as people join a church, their beliefs tend to change and become more in line with the rest of the kind of social group that they join. But I think one thing we highlight in your questions earlier, highlight about religious competition and Sarah's point about syncretism too, is the church's rules also shift over time. They're not static as well. And so in places where the economy is changing a lot or there's insecurity or other things, churches also shift their rules a little bit to better adapt to the beliefs and preferences of the people in their area. So I think some ongoing work is trying to document some of that. I have some stuff with Dean Yang and Trena Jensen from the University of Michigan trying to get at this. Sarah's doing some of this, Ben also. So this is nice for all of us to come and work together and think about these.
Religion can often thrive in places where the state is weak. Does that mean that the religion is replacing the institutions of the state because those institutions are not functioning well?
It's a difficult question. And Eduardo's touched on that a little bit, on all the functions that religious institutions tend to fulfill in many settings. And it's true that in many countries, religious institutions play a role and do fulfill certain functions that in other contexts we would think are a typical function of the state that includes indeed social welfare, social insurance, catering for the poor, health, education, and so on. And there too, there's been an increasing amount of fascinating work in economics, sort of studying this interplay between the state and religious institutions or actors. Sarah and Eduardo, in fact, they've studied traditional medicine in Africa, and religious providers tend to play a big role in that. I have some work on religious education in Indonesia, where Islamic schools play a big role and often compete with public schools to attract students. But of course, it's not always clear whether religious institutions take over these functions because the state is weak, or whether the state is weak because the expansion of the state historically and the buildup of state capacity has been constrained by the existence of these powerful and influential religious actors. And so in many ways, the equilibrium that we observe today is the outcome of really long historical processes in which the state and religious organizations have been competing for influence over many centuries.
In Europe, where I am, maybe not quite so much in the United States, where you guys are, then very often you would have no idea at all what the religious affiliation of most of the major politicians is. But in many places in the world, we do see religious leaders exercising political power. Is this increasing?
I would say that in many parts of the world, religious leaders have been facing the advance of the secular state over many decades or many centuries. And it's true that in many settings, they've successfully fought to preserve their influence. And so in some countries, not only Iran, but many countries in the Middle East, for example, religious actors, they remained embedded in the political system and they often play a very important institutional role. Many countries, for example, have a ministry of religion or a ministry of religious affairs. But even in places where they don't, they do continue to play an important political role. And there, I think you were hinting at, you know, Western settings as well. I think in Europe, perhaps religion is a little less present in politics than it is in the United States. That's also an ongoing area of research and one where I think we'll continue to see fascinating work in the next few years.
There's two ways to think about this from a policymaker's point of view, isn't it? That the religion is sort of competing with them for influence, or it's a force that could maybe get things done. Does the trend that you're seeing to religiosity in development settings, does that imply that policymakers could do well to partner with religious institutions or these religious leaders?
That's a very interesting and complex question, I think.
It's a very value-laden question as well, isn't it?
Partner is a complicated word, which can obscure the fact also that in many countries, you know, states simply have to work with religious actors and religious institutions. They have to compose with these really influential actors who have the capacity to mobilize voters, who have the capacity to remain influential in the policy sphere and to steer politics in a certain direction. So it might be the case that in some countries, you need to have the tacit consent of influential religious leaders to enact change in society. Whether this should happen in institutional way or not is a hard question.
Okay, maybe one that's a little bit more straightforward, at least in policy terms. Does this also warn us that there may be unintended consequences if you try to enact policies and you don't think about religious values or religious norms?
It's a question that many scholars in this literature think about a lot. You know, personally, I come from a country with a strong tradition of, you know, strong secularization policies, that is France. And on the one hand, I think it's an approach that has a lot of merit when it comes to alleviating religious divisions in the long run. You know, in France, we had centuries of conflict between Catholics and Protestants, and that partly explains why we ended up with a complete separation of church and state that we have today that we call laïcité in France. But on the other hand, there's a lot of evidence coming from economics and political economy that trying to suppress religious identity can lead to backlash. There's an excellent paper, for example, by Abdelgadir and Foucault in the American Political Science Review that looks at precisely that. They look at the effect of the French headscarf ban in public schools in the 2000s, and they find that this headscarf ban actually led to more daughters and girls with an immigration background to drop out of school. And so that's one example of an unintended consequence of a policy that indeed perhaps did not do a great job acknowledging local religious preferences of a subset of the student population.
In developing contexts, if we want to like not think about religion, we'll often miss a big part of how people interpret the world and see the world. And so in some ways, assuming people are always secular and don't have religious beliefs will give us an incorrect view of the way people think, and programs and policies might be less effective. So I'm thinking about the context of health and medicine, where if we don't understand how people think about this, how their traditional beliefs shape how they view medicine, or how local health institutions interact with religious denominations, like we might just be missing the way people think the local context properly. And so while I think it's nice sometimes coming from a Western country to not want to deal with religion, I think in many contexts, that's something that's not really possible. So I'll turn to Sarah because she's doing some really cool work on this.
So if we think about people's health choices, do you get vaccinated? Or like if you're feeling a particular set of symptoms like shortness of breath, do you go to the doctor? We might have a model for trying to improve access to healthcare where we say, oh, we just explain these symptoms to people, or we build health clinics and then they'll use them. But if we don't understand the way people think about disease and what causes disease, then we might completely miss the logic or the steps that they take to make their decisions about access to healthcare. So if you think disease is caused by spiritual origins because you've had some sort of bad incident with a neighbor or something, then you may not go to a doctor when you're feeling ill. You may go to a traditional healer who can address these types of spiritual ailments. So that means as a policymaker, if your goal is to, say, improve access to healthcare, you need to understand the religious landscape, these types of traditional beliefs, in order to help improve people's access to, you know, modern medicine or conventional medicine relative to traditional medicine.
You guys are doing fascinating work, and it sounds like there's a lot of work in progress. So I'll be seeing more of you in the future. I certainly hope I will anyway. But for now, thank you very much for talking about that. Thank you, Eduardo.
Thank you.
Sarah.
Thank you so much.
And Ben.
Thank you, Tim.
The paper is called Religion in Emerging and Developing Regions, and you've heard from all three of the authors, Sarah Lowes, Benjamin Marks, Eduardo Montero. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is follow us. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. All our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you find articles about the subjects that we feature. If you like what you're hearing, please tell someone else about us and leave us a review. We especially like the ones with 5 stars attached. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.